Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Spurs are once again jingling and jangling deep into the NBA playoffs. How do they do it year in and year out? The answers, two of them to be specific, are just ahead on Only a Game. Also, a new biography of the three baseball brothers DiMaggio, and I'll venture out to watch the sexes battle in a local roller derby ring. Also ahead, Boston schools forge a public-private partnership to overhaul the city's subpar sports opportunities for students.
We had one baseball team that's practicing in the glass-shattered schoolyard, getting prepared to play against these suburban teams that are out there in their beautiful green fields, and it was a really stark inequity at almost every level.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game is provided by Oliver Wyman. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA's Western Conference Finals begin on Sunday when the upstart Memphis Grizzlies take on the grizzled San Antonio Spurs, the team everyone outside the Alamo City hopes will just go away, but never does. The Spurs have never in their 37-year history gone two straight years without making the postseason, and they've made the playoffs 16 years in a row. Most credit to men who aren't your typical NBA headline grabbers. Paul Flav of Texas Public Radio has the story.
There are a couple of strands that run through the Spurs' last 16 seasons. One is all-star forward Tim Duncan. The other is two-time Coach of the Year Greg Popovich. The two have been in more postseason series than any other coach-player duo in NBA history. They share a mutual trust of each other and a weariness of the media.
Did you just come in?
That's Coach Pop in a May 4th interview during a Spurs practice.
You guys, you stay up all night thinking of these questions? Jesus, what?
The 37-year-old Duncan deals with the press not like a man who's a leader in seven NBA postseason stats categories, or like a guy who's been called the best power forward ever. Rather, he's sheepish, soft-spoken, dodging eye contact. He answers questions quickly, with humility, and without overreaching or speculating.
I've done the same stuff for a long time. There's not a whole lot of variation to my game.
It's this low-key attitude that's been the hallmark of the Spurs on and off the court. Their business-like play has gotten the Spurs labeled as boring to watch, with Duncan as the dull, predictable face of the franchise, a persona reflected in the headlines of The Onion.
Tim Duncan offers to do taxes for entire Spurs team.
Tim Duncan calls out geometric angle needed to make a bank shot.
Tim Duncan around if any Spurs have questions about sequester.
Tim Duncan hams it up for the crowd by arching left eyebrow slightly.
Tim Duncan announced a shoe deal with Florsheim. It's like not even an athletic shoe, you know? It's like a really dull, comfortable like shoe that you would wear if you had to be standing up all day.
Chad Nackers is the sports editor at The Onion. He admits that the running stories about Duncan are based only loosely on the athlete. Nackers says Duncan comes off as the nice guy in the NBA, and that in the NBA, that's kind of boring. NBA.com writer Scott Howard Cooper says if Duncan and the Spurs lack the bombast and personality of some teams, it's by design.
There's a clear understanding of what it means to be with the Spurs, and that is you show up to work, you don't make excuses, you put in whatever time is necessary to be successful.
Howard Cooper doesn't think the Spurs are boring to watch, and he believes their success has as much to do with the front office as it does with the players.
The players are what are making this happen, but it's the front office that is getting the players, and that's a huge part of what has happened here through the years.
Spurs general manager R.C. Buford has chosen well, despite the disadvantage of routinely drafting at the bottom of rounds. All-star point guard Tony Parker was a late first-round pick, and Manu Ginobili was drafted late in the second. Howard Cooper says the Spurs front office has always known what it is doing. The proof?
Look how many coaches get hired out of San Antonio to go be coaches in other organizations. People know the background of what goes on in this organization, and they want that in their organization.
From a business standpoint, the Spurs also excel. The value of the team quadrupled in the past 16 years, going from $122 million to $527 million, according to a recent Forbes article, which also named the Spurs as North America's best-run professional sports franchise. Webster University economics professor Patrick Riche wrote that article.
The metrics weren't overly complicated, simply looking at the historic fact that you have a team that 16 consecutive years with extremely high winning percentage, making the playoffs, 50-win seasons, something that you just have not seen any other team, certainly in the NBA, but for that matter, when you look at other sports.
As for the rest of the playoffs, expect more of the same from the Spurs. On the court and in the interview room.
Here's the one you guys didn't ask everybody. You think this first game is what on a scale, how important is this first game? Nobody's asked that one yet, you know?
For Only a Game, I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
This week, the family of deceased former NHL player Derek Bogard filed a wrongful death lawsuit accusing the league of over-medicating Bogard and ignoring the consequences of the concussions that he had suffered. Bogard died after an accidental prescription drug overdose in 2011. He was an enforcer who racked up career totals of 589 penalty minutes and 66 fights. Joining me is Nathan Fenno, who's written about the case for The Washington Times. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
The specifics of this lawsuit charge that during the 2008-2009 season, NHL doctors and staffers gave Bogard prescriptions for 1,021 pills, and over another 16-day period, he got 150 oxycodone pills. The motive was what, to keep him on the ice at all costs?
That seems to be what Bogard's attorneys claim, and it's hard to draw another conclusion with such excessive amounts of medication.
After his death, doctors found evidence in Bogard's brain of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This is, of course, the same condition found in the brains of numbers of ex-NFL players, over 4,000 former football players currently suing the NFL. Is the Bogard family suit likely to lead to more suits on behalf of former hockey players?
You know, that seems to be a prevailing sentiment among folks who follow these sorts of things, that this could lead to litigation similar to what's plaguing the NFL right now, where over 4,000 of these former players are suing the league. The NFL has had to respond in just a wide variety of ways, from a $30 million donation to the National Institutes of Health to rules changes. The NHL has made some smaller steps, but not anything nearly on the scale the NFL has been forced into, essentially.
What is the National Hockey League's defense likely to be in the Bogard suit?
From a legal perspective, the first place they'll go to is the idea of the preemption, that the collective bargaining agreement essentially preempts these claims from being made in a court setting. The NFL has tried that same tack with its concussion lawsuits, and that's currently being adjudicated and will probably be decided this fall. The other thing they'll try to do is remove it to federal court and argue that's a more proper venue than the state court in which it was filed. So those will be the first two things to look for there.
Do you think this case will create or perhaps increase the public debate about the issue of whether the NHL should continue to not only allow fights, but really assume that they're part of the game as it's played in the NHL?
I think that's one of the most important parts of this, and I think a public conversation is a very healthy thing about that. You know, should fighting be a part of the game, particularly when we can start to look at some of these consequences? If you can draw a line between fighting and a man's life being driven to addiction and CTE and some of these dark consequences, you know, is that really worth it just to be entertained or because it's traditional?
Do you think there's any difference among fans of the NHL and fans of the NFL in terms of how they feel about changing the game, perhaps making it less dangerous for players?
I would imagine there's a similar mentality, yeah, not wanting to see a game watered down. At the same time, with the NFL, you have these very stark cases, Dave Duerson or Junior Seau or Ray Easterling, people whose lives have been torn apart after they've left the game. And once you start to dig into these things, it changes your perspective on the sport, or at least provides context for watching it. There haven't been as many of those cases publicized with the NHL. And the more Bogards there are out there, or similar lawsuits that bring these tough situations to light, I think the more that could impact how people view the game.
Do you have any sense of when there will be a ruling on the Bogards family suit?
Oh, I think this will be something that drags on for an extended period of time. The first NFL lawsuits for head injuries were filed in the summer of 2011, and they're nowhere near close to being resolved. I think we'll have a similar situation here.
Nathan Fenno has written about the Bogard family lawsuit against the National Hockey League, and you can find a link to his article at onlyagame.org. Nathan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
The 138th running of the Preakness in Baltimore, flying hooves and flowing fetlocks, things of that nature. But what about the shoes? Horseshoes, that is. Reporter Sam Gallant of WTMD in Towson, Maryland, has the story of the Baltimore equine shoe specialist with an impressive track record.
Athletes know that footwear plays a major role in performance and comfort. The same goes for equine athletes. Just ask David Erb. He's the president of Victory Racing Plates, an 85-year-old horseshoe manufacturer based in Baltimore.
Just like when you go into a sporting goods store and you look at the wall and see all the different shoes for human runners or human competition, there are many, many different styles for horses as well.
You can't just lace up a horseshoe like a Nike or a Reebok. It takes a lot of work to swap out shoes for racehorses, which are reshod about every 3 weeks.
Hoofs come in all different shapes. We make a standard shape to use as the basis for any shoeing job, but the farrier's job is to adapt that shoe by bending it using a hammer and a stall jack to conform to the actual configuration of the hoof. One size does not fit all, although many times the shoe comes out of the box and goes right on the hoof without any modification because we hit it dead on in our shape.
That's better. A farrier, or blacksmith, is the person doing the work with horseshoes or racing plates. One such farrier working in Maryland is Joe Ludford, who describes the difference between steel shoes and aluminum racing plates.
This is a steel one, this is an aluminum one, and you can see the difference in the wear. This is the ground level. It wears at its toe much more on the aluminum and around the edges, and also wears where the foot moves. And that's from the wall moving back and forth across the aluminum. It wears it. Every time they hit the ground, the wall opens up, and then it closes. It opens up and closes.
Back at the Victory Racing Plate Factory, David Erb takes us on a tour. The process for making these horseshoes is intensive. They start with coiled aluminum, bend it, press it, heat it, cut it, drill it, polish it, and then box it up to send it out to farriers the world over. David says technology has allowed them to make horseshoes lighter and stronger, and that an ounce on the foot is worth a pound on the back of a horse. Even Seabiscuit wore aluminum Victory racing plates.
Seabiscuit actually wore Victory racing plates during the entire campaign, you know, of Seabiscuit's life. In the movie, it's interesting that they show this big, heavy steel shoe in a scene in the barn. And someone like me, I would pick up on that. Maybe the average person wouldn't even see that it was a steel horseshoe. But that horseshoe would never, ever be used on a real thoroughbred racehorse. It's just far too heavy.
Seabiscuit never won a Triple Crown. And in over 100 years of racing, it's only been done 11 times. Out of those 11, 8 of the winners wore Victory racing plates. For Only a Game, I'm Sam Gallant.
To view Sam Gallant's Victory Racing photos, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Mario Balotelli, the exceedingly high-profile star of Italian soccer team AC Milan, is famously fond of go-karts. When he played for Manchester City, he had a go-kart track built into the garden outside his home. That's why his AC Milan contract includes a clause specifically forbidding him from getting into one of the carts lest he hurt himself pursuing his hobby. But there's nothing in that contract forbidding Balotelli from getting into his own Ferrari 450 while it happens to be in a go-kart facility, such as the one at Palakkad Karting Complex right there on the outskirts of Milan. And so last week, that's what he did. Said Palakkad owner Joe Ghirangheli, "We let him take his new Ferrari out on the track and he was roaring around laughing and having fun." Don't you love a story in which fun prevails?
There's no room to rumble in a sports car.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Vincent, Dominic, and Joseph battled for brotherly baseball bragging rights, and guess who won? But first, over the past decade, while Boston's pro sports teams were hoisting trophies bearing the names of Lombardi and O'Brien, ending Babe Ruth's curse, and drinking from Lord Stanley's cup, Boston public school soccer teams were practicing without a goal. Only a Game's Karen Given and Doug Trabu have been looking into the sad state of sports in Boston schools and two privately funded organizations working to turn it all around. They're here now with this report.
Over the past 6 months, we've met a lot of kids in the Boston public schools, kids like junior Jaquiel Smith.
I love my school. I wouldn't want to leave my school.
But a year ago, Jaquiel wasn't even bothering to go to class. That changed when he earned a spot on the basketball team.
We've also met a lot of kids like Narion Jones, an eighth grader at Boston's Lila G. Frederick Middle School.
I love football and I want to mess it up by not getting good grades in all my classes.
But 4 years ago, football wasn't even offered in Boston's middle schools.
4 years ago, the city's sports program was the subject of a scathing series in the Boston Globe. Investigative reporter Bob Holler found problems that were downright scary.
We had one baseball team that's practicing in the glass-shattered, schoolyard, a baseball team, getting prepared to play against these suburban teams that are out there in their beautiful green fields. And it was a really stark inequity at almost every level.
The detail I can't get over is that until 2009, the city had one part-time trainer for 3,000 student-athletes. And some Boston suburbs were spending nearly three times as much as the city to support a football team.
Across the country, parents pay fees for their kids to participate in sports, but most inner-city families can't afford that. 75% of students in the Boston public schools receive free or reduced lunch.
But my sense is that's no excuse for what we need to accomplish going forward.
That's John Fish, the CEO of a major construction firm. He pledged $1 million a year through his company's charitable foundation and raised millions more. Fish founded the Boston Scholar Athletes, a program that pays for uniforms and equipment, training for coaches, and all-star games and banquets.
It's about shared responsibilities, about people working together and sort of, lending a hand and putting their shoulder to the wheel, both in time and in money, to make a difference.
And it's a lot of money. The Boston Public Schools spend $3.1 million a year on sports. The Boston Scholar Athletes spend another $3.1 million, and they stick around to run the program in partnership with the district. Boston Public School Superintendent Carol Johnson says cities around the country are intrigued.
I think it is an unusual model to have a sustained relationship. That level of investment is really pretty significant and I think is probably unheard of in other communities.
And Boston has an unusual relationship with not just one, but two charities. The city's middle schools are working with another group called Play Ball. In March, at the Mildred Avenue Middle School in the city's Mattapan neighborhood, I took in a double Dutch tournament. Jonna Washington's been jumping for 2 years.
It keeps me in shape, I guess. It does everything for me. I get good grades because of it.
In double Dutch, two girls twirl two white ropes simultaneously while their teammates bounce and jump between them. They twist themselves like contortionists during elaborate routines. Jonna says the sport motivates her in the classroom.
Because if I get lower than a C, then I can't be able to jump.
Linda Diggs Ferreira coaches a team from the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School.
I'm tired of hearing about all the violence on the street. Programs like this get the kids off the streets, into the gyms. It gives them something to work toward. They can do something positive.
That's why Michael Harney founded Play Ball in 2005. The Boston resident and former Georgetown University lacrosse player wanted to focus on the middle schools.
It seemed like a really important age, especially for city kids. It's really where they can maybe sometimes make decisions, and whether they want to continue to stay in school, whether they, what are they doing between 4 and 7 if they're not playing sports, right?
Before 2009, Boston's 12,000 middle school students had two sports options, track and basketball. Today, Play Ball funds 4 additional sports and has teams in more than half of the city's middle schools.
The Boston Scholar Athletes support sports that already existed. The biggest component of that support is 19 zones, large classroom tutoring centers.
Take advantage of your time so you be productive.
Long after the final bell, the doors to the zone are open for athletes who need a safe and reasonably quiet place to study.
What my mind state 2 years ago was, all right, come to school for my friends to see my friends.
Junior Jaquiel Smith loves playing basketball, but for the first 2 years of high school, he was academically ineligible to play, even though the district only requires a 1.67 GPA. That's a low C. Then he found the zone.
Now it's forget the friends, come to school to do my work, come to school to get somewhere in life, to take my mother out this neighborhood, away from all the drama.
To turn his high school career around, the 6'5" Smith needed qualified tutors, the promise of playing time, and the dogged determination of 5'2" zone facilitator Talene Taylor.
Miss T, you know, she don't give up on nobody. You tell her you don't want to do it, she just won't give up. She'll still try every time. So I made it.
Jaquiel hasn't just made it. His GPA is now above a 4.0. He has plans for college and hopes of making the NBA. And he calls his teammates every morning to make sure they all show up on time for school.
The middle school program Play Ball hopes to catch kids like Jaquiel earlier so that they have a better chance of success in high school and beyond. Play Ball is currently spending $400,000 to $500,000 a year to fund sports in Boston's middle schools. To keep costs low, a dozen board members pitch in with administrative work. Play Ball founder Michael Harney says 4 years into the partnership with the city, he's still excited about expanding.
My only regret with this is that we haven't moved faster, because when you get to see 1,000 kids at work every year, it's awesome. So I think we're kind of just getting started.
In late April, cheerleaders at the Boston Scholar Athletes annual fundraiser were pretty excited as well. In a single night, the organization raised $1.7 million. They're going to need it. The program already reaches 4,000 student athletes, but as the quality of sports in the schools improves, more and more kids want to play. John Fish would like to expand his program to other urban school districts. Boston Scholar Athlete Zone facilitator Jarek Walker thinks it's a great idea.
A lot of inner city schools have these similar problems where we didn't really do anything new or different. We just came in and told the kids, you can do it. These kids just need motivation. Once they're motivated, they work so hard.
But Bob Holler, the investigative reporter who started this all, worries that there might be a dangerous precedent being set in Boston.
A lot of people think, hey, this is a public obligation. We shouldn't be having to have charitable organizations or people come in and do the job that the public should be doing to support their kids in the schools.
Wherever the funding comes from, Kashim Shavis thinks sports are worth the price. He's a custodian and football coach at the Rogers Middle School.
Because you get kids from all different walks of life, but they all come together for the same love, and you see that. And so you'll get a kid that's rough or a kid that's might be not as rough as the next, and they'll get along. When in a different setting, they won't get along. So I think that's beautiful.
And that's something that won't show up in a budget or a box score. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
And I'm Karen Given.
Karen Given and Doug Tribou's report completes a week-long series on our home station, WBUR Boston. Link to more stories and see video of a double Dutch tournament at onlyagame.org. On Thursday, David Beckham announced that when the French Ligue 1 soccer season ends, he will retire. As if they'd been eagerly anticipating that news, some soccer writers and commentators began chirping about how David Beckham had never been much of a player. They're wrong. As they say in England, he was grand, even brilliant at what he did best. He provided his teammates with passes so precise that those teammates almost couldn't miss the net, and his free kicks curled and dipped in ways that defied the efforts of goalkeepers, if not quite the laws of physics. David Beckham played on teams that won titles in the top leagues in England, Spain, the U.S., and France. He made 115 appearances for England's national side. His work ethic led his coach with the L.A. Galaxy, Bruce Arena, to say he's one of the most competitive people I've ever coached. He's the only player ever to have been honored in Tokyo with a 10-foot-high chocolate statue of himself, and also to have had his name in the title of a movie about young women determined to exceed family and cultural expectations. He may be the most recognizable athlete on the planet, and that's the result of canny marketing and qualities that have enabled Beckham to appeal to all sorts of people, but soccer is the platform from which that appeal was launched, and he'd hardly have sold all those jerseys and all that underwear if he hadn't been a consistently effective and durable player. Maybe he put Major League Soccer on the map, as Galaxy coach Arena suggested on Thursday. But even soccer fans who regard that claim as extravagant should be appreciative of what David Beckham has done for their game. When Vince DiMaggio told his father, a fisherman, that he intended to become a professional baseball player, Giuseppe DiMaggio was outraged. How can you make a living playing a silly game? But when Vince came home one day, put $1,500 on the kitchen table, and said he'd earned it playing ball, Giuseppe turned to Vince's younger brothers, Joe and Dominic, and asked, "When are you going to play baseball?" Tom Clavin includes that story in The DiMaggio's Three Brothers, Their Passion for Baseball, Their Pursuit of the American Dream. The author joins me from WPPB in Southampton, New York. Tom Clavin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me on the show. I've been looking forward to this.
Give us a sense of Giuseppe DiMaggio's background in order for us to understand how surprised he was that not just one but three of his sons could do just fine playing professional baseball.
Surprised is a mild word. I think astonished. They had a total of nine children, Giuseppe and Rosalie DiMaggio, and five of them were sons, and this was very happy news for him because he expected they'd all become fishermen and help make money for the family, put food on the table. And that worked with the first two sons, but Vincent came along and he rebelled, and then Joseph played baseball, and then the youngest Dominic played baseball, and in the later years of his life, Giuseppe couldn't have been more pleased. He was very proud of his sons and all the attention he got going to the World Series games, but it was for him something that was totally unimaginable, that three of his sons would play this silly game called baseball and beyond that become very well off financially doing it.
Vince DiMaggio, who eventually played for several teams in the National League, introduced younger brother Joe to organized baseball on the West Coast. Do you think he was surprised when Joe's career took off the way Vince's never quite did?
Vince was a very good ball player, but Joe had that talent. He had a gift, and so I don't think he was surprised that Joe's career took off. Vince was a two-time All-Star. He had power. He played mostly for the Pittsburgh Pirates. But he would have loved to play for the Yankees. He would have loved to share an outfield with Joe. It embittered him a little bit over time that Joe didn't really lift a finger. I mean, let's face it, he was Joe DiMaggio. If at any point he had said to Yankee management, "You know, I'd like my brother Vince to be on the team with me," they would have done it in a heartbeat.
Your book includes several anecdotes about exchanges between Joe and Dominic as they ran past each other between innings when the Yankees, for whom Joe played his entire career, faced Dom's Red Sox. Pick a favorite encounter for us.
Everybody is aware that Joe DiMaggio had a 56-game hitting streak in 1941, and that has never been broken. But Dominic in 1949 had a 34-game streak. He had started that streak on July 4th against the Yankees, and here it is, the 35th game after that. He's got 34 games. He's catching up on his brother. Of all people, you know, Joe's got to think, it's my own brother who might break my record. And Dominic gets up against Vic Rashi, and he's 0-for-3 against Rashi, gets up the fourth time, and he really connects with one, sends a screamer out to the outfield. Well, who was the one who tracked it down and nabbed it and broke his brother's hitting streak but Joe? For Joe, that was kind of revenge because in their exchanges and who had stolen base hits away from the other, Dominic was way ahead. He had robbed Joe of more hits than Joe had robbed him, so this was revenge for Joe.
Though folks might have expected three brothers all playing in the major leagues to be close, that really wasn't the case, was it?
Well, it wasn't. In the case of Vincent, because he was in the National League his entire career, he never really crossed paths during the season with either of his brothers. In the case of Joe and Dominic, because they were in the same league, they were rivals with the Red Sox and the Yankees, the competition was very fierce. So it wasn't like when they got together, they were all that chummy, certainly not on the field. I interviewed Yogi Berra for this book, and he talked about Dominic being a little bit more of the friendlier one. Yogi was friendlier with Dominic than he was with his teammate.
You include The Pursuit of the American Dream in the subtitle of The DiMaggios. With respect to that pursuit, Joe got most of the glory, and he was the one who married the movie star, Marilyn Monroe. But would it be an exaggeration to say the dream eventually went sour for him?
It did. He did not have a very happy life after baseball. Yes, he was always celebrated and insisted on being identified as the greatest living ball player. And he would always get the rousing standing ovations at Old Timers Day, and he never had to put his hand in his pocket. You know, drinks and meals were always on other people. But he was a pretty unhappy man. Obviously, his marriage to Marilyn Monroe didn't take. He never got married again. He just had one son with whom he was estranged for the rest of his life. And it was Dominic who really realized the American dream. After baseball, he became a very successful businessman. He and his wife, Emily, were married for 61 years. They had three children, the first three DiMaggio children of that generation to go to college. He had happiness, he had family, and he had money.
Yeah, you characterized Joe DiMaggio toward the end of his life. I'm quoting now. He was a captive of his own cult. And Dominic really turned out to be just the opposite. I mean, everybody that you spoke to had wonderful things to say about him and about how he brought up his family and even how he felt toward his brothers who didn't feel so great toward him.
Dominic was very, very involved with family, his own family, of course, his wife and his children, but the extended family. He had four brothers and four sisters, and he wanted to take care of all of them. He certainly, with a couple of his sisters, he helped them out when they needed some help financially. He tried to help Vince as best he could. He was the one who basically buried all his siblings. I mean, he came back from Joe's funeral. He said to his son, his oldest son, "I've now buried all my siblings. I'm the only one left." And that he had family right up until his last day, he died at the age of 92, was the realization of a happy life for him.
Tom Clavin is the author of The DiMaggios, Three Brothers, Their Passion for Baseball, Their Pursuit of the American Dream. The book is published by HarperCollins, and the author joined me from WPPB in Southampton, New York. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
If you'd like to win a copy of Tom Clavin's new book, The DiMaggios, follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio, then tweet at us with the hashtag DiMaggios this weekend. We'll pick a couple of lucky winners next week and follow them back to get in touch. That's on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. I'm gonna tell you just the way I feel.
Support for Only A Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Best Buy. This is NPR.
Not satisfied with being one of the world's top poker players, Phil Ivey set about making a fortune at Baccarat, and he succeeded, or at least that's how it seemed. Last summer at Crockford's, a London casino, Ivey and a person the casino regards as an accomplice won nearly £8 million, about $12 million, at the Baccarat table. But not so fast, cowboy. The casino, which failed to pay the winner, has said in London's High Court that Mr. Ivey provoked the dealer to inadvertently sort the cards and give him an advantage which I'm incapable of understanding. Otherwise, I too would have won almost $12 million at Baccarat and by now wouldn't be telling you this intriguing story. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Irresistible Maelstrom meets Immovable Massacre. It's the men against the women of roller derby. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
You get all the cool assignments.
Absolutely true. The Memphis Grizzlies will meet the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA's Western Conference Finals. You have mentioned the Spurs' unwillingness to, quote, get out of the way before. Do they step aside this time for the Grizzlies?
No, but I think the Grizzlies can shove them aside. The Grizzlies actually have a nice little path to the NBA Finals right now. And I think right now they're playing just about as well as anybody in the league. So I do think it will be a long series. The Spurs will not give way easily, but they will give way.
The Sacramento Kings will stay in Sacramento one day after NBA owners voted to block the team's move to Seattle. The current owners agreed to sell the team to software billionaire Vivek Ranadive. And are you surprised by this turn of events?
I'm a little bit surprised. I'm a little bit sad because, you know, what dirt was done to Seattle in terms of losing their franchise. But then again, you're starting to, if you're rooting to help out a city that had its franchise stolen by letting it steal another city's franchise, you're sort of tying yourself up in ethical knots. So, you know, Sacramento's, it's absurd to have an NBA franchise in Sacramento, but we're going to have one for a while.
The current, though not for long, co-owner of the Sacramento team, George Maloof, hid in a closet after the will of the NBA became clear. I assume his attempts to avoid reporters by doing that were not successful.
Well, the problem with hiding in a closet is that sooner or later you have to, like, come out of the closet,
unless
as it were.
Stockpiled food and water.
We're falling into an old South Park episode here. I mean, unless there's, like, a back... How many closets do you know have, like, back doors that let you out onto the driveway? So, yes, the reporters just sort of waited around outside the closet until he came back out.
In other basketball news, WNBA number one draft pick Brittany Griner has apparently decided to warm up for the season by learning a new shot. Who's her teacher?
Well, none other than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's teaching her the skyhook. And I think this is a brilliant idea, and why more very tall male basketball players don't take advantage of this tutorial is beyond me.
The NHL defending champion LA Kings struggled a bit this season, but now they've won 12 games in a row at home, and they are up in their second round series against the San Jose Sharks. So is this one of these peaking at the right time sort of stories?
Well, I mean, because of the truncated season and the accelerated playoff schedule, anything unusual can happen in the NHL playoffs this year, and obviously the Kings have decided to get hot at the right time.
This week, a Chicago law firm filed a wrongful death lawsuit on behalf of the family of former NHL enforcer Derek Bogard, who died in 2011 of an accidental drug overdose. Bogard was 28 years old, and an autopsy of his brain showed evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But brain damage is not the whole story here, is it?
No, the family is arguing that both the team and the league acted negligently in regards to Bogard's death, especially in prescribing him painkillers. And some of the details in the lawsuit are astonishing. For example, in 2008-2009, Bogard received from the medical staff of the Minnesota Wild 40 prescriptions for a total of 1,201 painkillers. Now, I mean, you do that on the street and the FBI comes knocking at your door at 2 o'clock in the morning.
The Minnesota Vikings have revealed drawings of their proposed new stadium. To me, it looks like one of those giant cathedrals that's home to a televangelist. What do you think?
Yeah, it's got a clear roof. It seems
it's got a flying buttress.
Giant windows. It has a prow. I was about to say a prow. And it does. It looks like something that dropped in from, like, Jedi headquarters in Star Wars.
NASCAR lost one of its greats this week. Charlie Dick Trickle died of an apparent suicide at the age of 72. I was not paying attention to stock car racing during the era when Trickle won 67 short track races in a single year, but perhaps you were?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, because a lot of the races took place in Wisconsin, and because I lived there for a while, and he was a very big celebrity in Wisconsin. They called him the White Knight because his car was white. I mean, he was a specialist in an era where the specialty was sort of dying out and being swallowed up by the major corporate entity that was NASCAR.
O.J. Simpson, currently serving a sentence of 9 to 33
Another
years.
Another person I've missed from the news, by the way.
9 to 33 years is what he's serving in prison for armed robbery, kidnapping, and other charges. Back in court this week, he claims he was sent to prison for following the advice of his attorney, which sounds a little unlikely. Explain, please.
Well, according to him, he got thrown in jail for allegedly stealing his own memorabilia back from people who owned it. Of course, O.J. says, it was my stuff. I followed what I thought was the law. My lawyer told me I couldn't break into a guy's room. Good lawyer right there.
He didn't do that.
You can't break into a guy's room. He says he didn't anyway. I didn't try to muscle the guys. The guys had my stuff, even though they claimed they didn't steal it. No, they bought it.
You have to wonder if it ever occurred to him to find another lawyer.
I wonder if it ever occurred to him that, like, he should have gone off and, you know, having hit the criminal justice lotto once in his life, he should have gone off and lived on a farm somewhere.
Finally, Charlie, Roman Abramovich.
Sports!
This is sports.
No,
this
it's
guy,
not. No,
this,
it's not.
This Russian gentleman owns the English Premiership side Chelsea, and he also owns the world's largest private luxury yacht, which he brought into New York City recently. And I know it's a stretch as a sports story, but I just couldn't resist the chance to ask you to describe this yacht for me.
Well, first of all, it is almost as big as the Bismarck was. It's two-thirds the size of the Bismarck, which, like, dominated, you know, Atlantic shipping in the early years of World War II.
And it has more armaments.
Oh, well, we'll start with it. It has a missile defense system,
sure.
Armor plating, bulletproof windows, a laser shield system to deter paparazzi. Now, I don't know that that means you can't take pictures, or if you try to take a picture, you're rendered a pile of smoking meat on the dock.
Your camera explodes in
your face. But it also has two swimming pools, a private cinema, a discotheque, two helipads, and a submarine against the advent of a quick getaway.
Sure, yeah. Anyway.
This is not a yacht.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill.
In May of 1941, the war had just begun. The Germans had the biggest ship that had the biggest guns. The Bismarck was the fastest ship that ever sailed the sea. On her decks were guns as big as steers and shells as big as trees. Out of the cold and foggy night.
Willis Reed played on an injured leg in the 1970 NBA Finals, thus inspiring his Knicks teammates to a championship performance. In Game 5 of the 1997 Finals, Michael Jordan took the court with a fever of 103 degrees and scored 38 points. These are the sorts of performances some basketball historians have invoked in the discussion of why Derrick Rose did not return from knee surgery to help the Chicago Bulls, who were eliminated from the playoffs by the Miami Heat on Wednesday night. Joining me is John Greenberg, columnist for ESPN Chicago. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill.
Derrick Rose had successful knee surgery last year. He was cleared to play in early March, and you have written that the story of his return is, quote, the biggest hoax in Chicago history. Does the use of the word hoax mean you think Rose never intended to return to the Bulls this season?
I don't think he had much of a plan to. I think it was never completely closed, but I think all along, and this goes from the team, Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the Bulls, told him from the beginning, do not rush this. You know, he's 24 years old. He's got they'd like him to play for, you know, another 10 years here in Chicago. So he was told not to rush it. And then his people, his agent, his family, and all, you know, all the people around him, they told him not to rush it. Now, that isn't to say he didn't work on his rehab, because I watched him do it, and he worked his tail off. You know, the Adidas marketing campaign was called The Return, and that was, you know, this documentary series. It was all to sell shoes, and I think any intelligent person realized that. But it also, you know, was meant to kind of evoke these images of him coming back. And the fact that he didn't do it, you know, became like a huge joke. And as I was writing my column yesterday, I thought about that, you know, the Al Capone's vault in Geraldo. You know, that's kind of what it made me think of.
Rose has taken a lot of heat, so to speak, from fans and from some writers. But shouldn't any athlete be allowed to make the decision about when he's ready to come back after a serious injury?
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's what people forget, you know. And I think a lot of the anger and the disappointment about this is because people love watching him play. You know, he's such a dynamic player. He's from Chicago. And I understand people were worried that maybe he's a little too much inside his own head. But I can understand him being wary if he's not completely confident on it. Would that lead to other injuries? Would that, you know, would it mess him up mentally?
Is it fair to say that this story would never have become such a big deal if back in March Rose hadn't said he didn't want to come back before he could dunk off his left leg and that he wanted to be, quote, 110% before he returned?
Yeah, absolutely. He hadn't talked to the local media, and then all of a sudden the story came out in USA Today. I know his people set it up. It wasn't the Bulls. They were kind of blindsided by it. It wasn't Adidas. They had no idea this was coming. I think that his people wanted to put out there, like, hey, you know, everyone's saying he's coming back this day, this day, this day. You know, that's not 100%. I think the Bulls handled it well in that they never aired him out to dry, but, you know, there's definitely some disagreements between Rose's team and the Bulls, and some of it goes back a number of years.
If Derrick Rose had come back for the playoffs, and if he'd been reasonably close to game ready when he did it, would his presence have made a difference in the series against the Heat?
Yeah, it would have made somewhat of a difference, but I don't know, you know, can a guy miss a whole season and come back against the NBA champions? He's so good, even at 85-90%. Of course, he would have made some difference. Would he have led them to a victory? You know, I extremely doubt that.
Chicago, of course, is the city where Michael Jordan displayed such exceptional determination to play and to continue winning no matter how often he'd won. Does this mean being Derrick Rose in May of 2013 is harder than it would have been to be Derrick Rose if he'd been employed somewhere else?
Yeah, I think you do get measured against him. He is unique enough to carve out his own legacy. But it's interesting because I think to a lot of people, he's going to have to live this down. A lot of people think he is less of a star because he didn't come back to play. You know, people are going to question every time he misses a game with injury. You know, I don't know how long it'll take. It could be till he wins a title.
John Greenberg is a columnist for ESPNChicago.com. John, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, always. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Let's get ready to roll.
It's a quiet, sunny spring evening in Wilmington, Massachusetts, but you wouldn't know it inside the Shriners Auditorium, where it's kind of dark and pretty noisy, because roller derby is noisy and kind of dark and a little mysterious, at least until it's explained to me that points are scored when jammers fight their way through the pack for a pass, roar around the oval-shaped track, and fight their way through the pack for another pass. So that's as straightforward as skating in circles can be, except that the second contest on the card on this particular evening offers entertainment unusual even by roller derby standards. It will pit the all-male Central Massachusetts Maelstrom against the all-female Boston Massacre, the latter featuring such fearsome personages as Dixie Kicks, Dottie Danger, Maya Mangalew, and...
My real name is Amy Chilton, and my roller derby name is Bad Person.
Bad Person.
Yeah.
You don't look the least bit like a bad person.
Well, it's meant to be kind of ironic and joke.
Aha, said I to myself. And then I asked Bad Person about the unusual challenge of skating against a team of men.
It is a different game with the men. We're used to being able to move more people on the track, so we kind of have to change our strategy a little bit. So that makes us a little nervous, but we have scrimmaged them before, so it's not, you know, we're not totally walking into the dark on this.
When you say move more people on the track, do you mean knock them down, shoulder them?
Yeah, hit them, move them where they don't want to go. Usually when we're playing against other people about our size, it's a little easier, but some of these guys are our size, so.
I backed away from Bad Person, cautiously, and approached a member of the all-male Central Massachusetts Maelstrom with the utterly pedestrian name of Richard Gannett. He discounted his team's advantages of size and strength.
I would say that with derby, it's a lot more finesse. Your ability on skates, as far as playing derby goes, is actually more of how you can manipulate yourself on the skates. It's not necessarily your mass or how big you are or anything like that.
I got to say they got the advantage because they're using those goofy names.
Absolutely. I actually like a lot of their names. They do have a lot of good names. Like I said, I skated under Striker up to last season, but this year I kind of wanted to, you know, take my own name and kind of go with that. Have that be my persona in derby this year.
No hiding behind some moniker like Ginger Kid or Speed Metal there, and maybe it didn't matter. The referee, who called himself Three Day Bender, didn't think it did. He's the guy who told me that roller derby is misunderstood.
One of the first questions I get when I tell people that I'm a roller derby referee is, roller derby has rules? Or aren't you guys like professional wrestling? Because everyone's used to the roller derby of the 70s and 80s, where it was fixed. It was promoted much like professional wrestling is now, and was then.
Yeah, I said. But men against women, is that a special challenge for the officials?
Yes and no. The men's game and the women's game are played under the same rule set, but you'll often hear them say, same rules, different game. So it's a little bit of a challenge, but many of our crew tonight have experience working with both the men and the women.
Not the women and the men together.
Some of us do, some of us don't. It'll definitely be a challenge tonight, but it's one we're looking forward to.
Boston, Boston, pitch, pitch, pitch! Boston, Boston, pitch, pitch, pitch!
Bad Person, Vixen to Hit You, Maud Forbid, and the rest of the Boston Massacre took an early 7-0 lead, but the Central Mass Maelstrom quickly caught up, and by the time I asked Rammy Lammy for some play-by-play, they'd put the Massacre in the rearview mirror. Not Rammy Lammy thought necessarily for good.
Number 1993 for the Mass Maelstrom, the men's team, made pass after pass after pass after pass, and I think that's what really caused them to break apart. I wouldn't say it's certainly a big gap. It'll be a lot to catch up for the Massacre, for the women's team, but I wouldn't say that this gap at this point in the game precludes a victory by them.
She might have been right, but for a series of infractions, the first of which sent Bel Air Bomber to the penalty box, or more precisely, penalty bench. In any case, there she was.
I had a multiplayer block.
A multiplayer?
I held on to my teammate too long.
And they caught you?
And they caught me.
Well, I hope you get away with it next time.
Thank you.
Moments later, Vixen Tehitcha was also sent to the sin bin. I had to know why.
I don't know, to be honest with you. Yeah.
That's unfair.
Yeah, it is.
They sent you in here and you don't know why.
Well, I know why, but I don't believe it was true. Put it that way.
Okay. Maybe it was the penalties. Maybe it was that spurt 5 minutes in to which Rammy Lammy referred. Whatever the reason, the men of the Central Massachusetts Maelstrom prevailed over the women of the Boston Massacre 284-131. Maelstrom member Ryan Conlin was gracious in his assessment of the team that was second best that evening.
Boston is a very, very, very tough team. They've been around for a long time. They have a lot of smart players. They have a lot of smart coaches. Always nice to have good competition.
With that, Ryan Conlin rejoined his Central Mass Maelstrom teammates, perhaps to strategize for their next tilt with the men of the New York Shock Exchange, while the thoughts of the vanquished Boston Massacre turned to an upcoming rumble with the Calamity Janes of Maine.
She's the hottest little deal on eight wheels, burning like a babe out of hell. Jamming and a blocking and a little skull knocking, it's enough to make a grown man yell. Go, go, roller girl, look at that girl roll. Roller derby, save my soul.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our budgets and box score story was edited by Martha Little, with production assistance from Mike Garth, Paul Vikas, James Trout, Tiffany Campbell, Jesse Costa, Nate Goldman, Ben Swayze, Abby Elizabeth Conway, Forrest Marvez, and Martin Kessler, who leaves to make room for our new intern, Jasper Wilson. We also had help this week from Margaret Evans, Deb Becker, and Amanda Art. Our senior producer is Gary Wallen. Our final word comes from roller derby PA announcer Orion Wilson, who offers a tip on how to tell which team is better than another.
Well, looking at the scoreboard always helps.
I really wish I'd thought of that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
I'm talking about roller derby. She's the hottest little deal on eight wheels. Burning like a babe out of hell. Jamming and a blocking and a little stone. It's enough to make a grown man yell. Go, go, roller girl. Look at that girl roll.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. The SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture, poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.